Many music writers consider Martin Williams the dean of jazz criticism. For the past few years, he's worked at the Smithsonian Press, compiling a series of record anthologies, each highlighting a different facet of jazz or pop history. He's just completed his second big band anthology called Singers and Soloists of the Swing Bands. It showcases outstanding performances by big band singers and soloists. In the booklet which accompanies this six-record set, Williams writes, "Nothing is included here only for the sake of a quick trip down memory lane, or merely because it sounded good at the time, or because it sold a lot of copies way back when."
You buy a set of nostalgia-oriented records, you play them maybe once and at a party a month later, and that's about it. We were trying to pick stuff and make a case for this music that was durable. That's kind of the business we're in, and that's how I like to do things. It's easy enough to look at yesterday's top 40 and pull your discs out of it, but it is maybe not so easy to decide, well, I think this really sounds good still, and I think it'll sound good in 20 years and maybe 100 years.
Your new box set opens with Bing Crosby singing with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra. It's a 1929 recording of After You've Gone. Why did you begin with that recording?
Well, Crosby was the archetypal band singer who became a star later, who was singing as a featured vocalist with a prominent orchestra, and who then went on to have a big career after that. He's the beginning of that kind of thing in our popular music in this century, just about. Of course, that's a pattern that many others followed. Most successfully, of course, Frank Sinatra, after having been with Harry James and Tommy Dorsey. But there are many others, and several of them represented here. I think people would be surprised that Pearl Bailey was a band singer, that Lena Horne was a band singer.
I think for listeners who are used to considering Crosby the suburban crooner, it'll be very interesting to hear his 1929 performance of After You've Gone.
Oh, yeah. Crosby will surprise you. He really was heavily oriented in jazz before he became the romantic crooner. That's really where he learned everything.
After you've gone, left me crying. After you've gone, there's no denying. You'll feel blue, you'll feel sad. You'll miss the dearest pal you ever had. There'll come a time, now don't forget it. There'll come a time when you'll regret it. Someday, when you grow lonely, your heart will break like mine and you'll want me only. After you've gone away.
Some of the selections that you've chosen in your new set are similar to the classical concerto form. And I think especially of Echoes of Harlem, Duke Ellington's showcase piece for trumpeter Cootie Williams.
Yeah, very definitely. And he had that kind of thing in mind. In fact, the original title of that thing was Cootie's Concerto.
Well, this was a 1936 recording. Mm-hmm. Why did you make a point of including this in the set?
Because it's another example of an excellent vehicle piece featuring one soloist, one improvising player, out of the orchestra, standing down in front and having his great moment.
Anyone who thinks that the big bands are just for swing music of the 40s, the kind of music we associate with, say, Benny Goodman, you've included some much more modern-sounding music on it, and I think of Mingus Fingers, the Charles Mingus composition, where he's a featured soloist with the Lionel Hampton Band in 1947. Can you talk about that piece?
Well, that was something that Charlie had written for himself when he was quite a bit younger. And it's very much in the style that was called bebop, or what later began to be called modern jazz. Of course, it was the modern jazz of the middle 40s, and he was under the spell of Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker. And it's actually, if you really want to get technical, it's a quite ingenious use of the chord progression to Gershwin's I Got Rhythm, but it's patterned in quite an original way. And there were very few vehicles for bass players before this thing came out. I can think of only two. And therefore, this was, you know, an exceptional kind of thing for anybody to do. But Mingus played the bass like a great guitarist. But this was his first featured thing anywhere on records, except some records he had made on his own in the very small groups out in California before this.
I'll tell you one of the choices that really surprised me. Finding Chattanooga Choo Choo, the Glenn Miller, Tex Beneke, Modern Airs recording. I'll tell you the truth, to me that recording is roots of middle-of-the-road music, and I was really surprised to see it showing up.
Well, I quite agree. It is, you see, and that's one of the things that we discover in a thing like this, how this middle-of-the-road and very middle-American-oriented swing, because Miller was the guy who got the people in Cedar Rapids doing the jitterbug, not the ones that Benny Goodman got, who on the East and West Coast. And this is really a production number. In fact, it was specifically written for that, for a movie. And I went back and listened to it again, and I said, wow, that thing is really good for what it is. It's almost perfect.
Hi there, Tex, what you say?
Step aside, partner, it's my day. Bend an ear and listen to my version
of a really solid Tennessee excursion.
Pardon me, boy, is that the Chattanooga Juju?
Yes, yes, track 29.
Boy, you can give me a shine.
When you first started writing about jazz criticism, you really changed the way in which it was written. What was the state of jazz criticism like when you started writing about that music?
Did I? Well, I must say that I did say to myself, I think there's another way to do this. I don't think I said it was a better way, but there's a different way of looking at this. Of course, a lot of people, if you want me to talk personally, when I first started, many people said, oh, he doesn't really like music. He doesn't really like jazz. I guess nobody says that anymore.
They said that because you weren't just writing, I loved it, it was great, it was hot.
Well, it seemed to me that a lot of writers who were writing about jazz at that time had various clever ways of saying, golly gee whiz, or on the other hand, saying, yuck. And neither one of those things, however you phrase them, seemed to me to be really very much more than elementary. And I sort of said, well, you know, what is this thing I'm trying to either praise or damn? Have I really understood it? What is it technically? What is it emotionally? What are these people trying to do? And do I think it's worth doing? But the real questions I think that any critic ought to try to answer as best he or she can is, how and why do I say what I say? It isn't peddling opinions. It really ought to make the reader, sometimes force the reader to decide what he thinks. That's what it's really about.
At the beginning of our interview, you talked about how you want to see this music and have other people hear this music outside of the haze of nostalgia. Nevertheless, do you have a different way of hearing music that you actually grew up listening to, music that has personal associations for you, than you have of hearing music that you've come to with a certain distance between you and that music?
Well, I think I can divorce myself from remembering that, you know, that was the night when I held the first girl's hand for the first time or whatever. I think I can do that. Or what really pleases me is going back to some of these things and saying, I liked that when I was a teenager. Gosh, it really sounds good still. Now, that isn't always the case by a long shot, but when it does happen that way, it's very nice.
Jazz critic Martin Williams, singers and soloists of the Swing Bands, is available through the Smithsonian Institution.